the loss. "Everything all right downstairs, driver?" That's what she'd always say. And she would look at Mrs. Driver sideways out of those mocking old eyes of hers. "I wouldn't put it past her," Mrs. Driver exclaimed aloud, gripping her feather duster as though it were a club. "All right, my lady. Pry and potter all you want. Two can play at that game." Side four. Mrs. Driver was short with Crampfell that evening. She would not sit down and drink with him as usual, but stumped about the kitchen looking at him sideways. There was a kind of menace in her silence, a hidden something which no one could ignore. Even Aunt Sophie had felt it when Mrs. Driver had brought up her wine. She heard it in the clink of the decanter against the glass as Mrs. Driver set down the tray, and in the rattle of the wooden rings as Mrs. Driver drew the curtains. It was in the tremble of the floorboards as Mrs. Driver crossed the floor, and in the click of the latch as Mrs. Driver closed the door.
"What's the matter with her now?"
Aunt Sophie wondered vaguely, as delicately, ungreedily, she poured the first glass of wine. The boy had felt it too. When he was in bed, Mrs. Driver had gone through all his things, peering into cupboards and opening his drawers. She had pulled his suitcase out from under the wardrobe and found his dear dead mole and his hoard of sugar lumps and his best potato knife. But even then she had not spoken. She had thrown the mole into the waste paper basket. She had pocketed the potato knife and all the sugar lumps. She had stared at him a moment before she turned the gas low. A strange stare it had been, more puzzled than accusing. Mrs. Driver slept above the scullery. That night she did not undress. She set the alarm clock for midnight, unbuttoned her tight shoes, and crawled, grunting a little, under the eiderdown. She had barely closed her eyes, as she told Crampfell afterwards, when the clock shrilled off. Mrs. Driver tumbled herself out of bed. "Shh," she said to the clock, "shh," and clasped it to her bosom. She stood, in her stockinged feet, at the head of the scullery stairs. Something, it seemed, had flickered below, a hint of light. Mrs. Driver peered down the dark curve of stairway. Yes, there it was again, a moth-wing flutter. Candlelight, that's what it was, a moving candle somewhere within the kitchen. Clock in hand, Mrs. Driver creaked down the stairs. There seemed a sigh in the darkness, an echo of moment. And it seemed to Mrs. Driver, standing there on the cold stone flags, that this sound that was barely a sound could only mean one thing. The soft swing to of the green baize door, that door which led out of the kitchen into the main hall beyond. Hurriedly, Mrs. Driver felt her way into the kitchen and fumbled for matches along the ledge above the stove. She knocked off a pepper pot and a paper bag of cloves, and glancing downwards, saw a filament of light. She saw it in the second before she struck a match. A glowworm thread, it looked like, on the floor beside her feet, outlining a rough square. Mrs. Driver gasped and lit the gas, and the room leapt up around her. Cautiously, Mrs. Driver moved towards the stove. An object lay there, something pinkish, on the floor beside the jutting board. Ah, she realized, that board, that was where the light had come from. Mrs. Driver glanced around the kitchen. Everything else looked normal. The plates on the dresser, the saucepans on the wall, the row of tea towels hanging on their string above the stove. The pinkish object she saw now was a heart-shaped cashew box from the glassed-in tray table in the drawing room. She picked it up. It was enamel and gold and set with tiny brilliants. "Well, aunt," she began, and with a sudden, angry movement, she wrenched back the piece of floor. And then she shrieked, loud and long. She saw movement, a running, a scrambling, a fluttering. She heard a squeaking, a jabbering, a gasping. Little people they looked like, with hands and feet, and mouths opening. That's what they looked like. But they couldn't be that, of course. Running here and there and everywhere. "Oh, oh, oh!" she shrieked, and felt behind her for a chair. She clambered onto it, and it wobbled beneath her, and she climbed, still shrieking, from the chair to the table. And there she stood, marooned, crying and gasping and calling out for help, until there was a rattling at the scullery door. Crampfurl it was, roused at last by the light and the noise.
"What is it?" he called. "Let me in!"
But Mrs. Driver would not leave the table.
"A nest! A nest!" she shouted. "Alive and squeaking!"
Crampfurl threw his weight against the door and burst open the lock.
"Where?"
he cried, his eyes wide beneath his tousled hair.
"What sort of a nest?"
Mrs. Driver pointed to the floor. Crampfurl walked over in his slow, deliberate way and stared down. He saw a hole in the floor, cluttered with small objects. Children's toys, they looked like, bits of rubbish.
"It's nothing," he said. "It's that boy. That's what it is."
He stirred the contents with his foot.
"There ain't nothing alive in there." "But I saw them," gasped Mrs. Driver. "Little people, like with hands, or mice dressed up."
Crampfurl stared into the hole.
"Mice dressed up?"
"Hundreds of them," went on Mrs. Driver, "running and squeaking. I saw them, I tell you."
"Well," said Crampfurl stolidly, "maybe. But if you ask me, I think it's that boy, where he hides things."
His eye brightened, and he went down on one knee.
"Where he's got the ferret, I shouldn't wonder."
"Listen," cried Mrs. Driver, and there was a despairing note in her voice. "This wasn't no boy, and it wasn't no ferret." She lowered herself clumsily to the floor.
"They had hands and faces.
Look," she said, pointing. "See that? It's a bed. And now I come to think of it, one of them was in it."
"Now you come to think of it," said Crampfurl.
"Yes," said Mrs. Driver firmly. "And there's something else I come to think of. Remember that girl, Rosa Pickhatchet? Well, she saw one on the drawing-room mantelpiece with a beard."
"One what?" asked Crampfurl.
Mrs. Driver glared at him.
"What I've been telling you about. One of these...
"Mice dressed up," said Crampfurl. "Not mice," Mrs. Driver almost shouted. "Mice don't have beards."
"But you said," began Crampfurl.
"Yes, I know I said it. Not that these had beards. But what could they be but mice?" She went to the stove and picked up the fire tongs.
"Move over. Let me get at the owl."
One by one, Mrs. Driver picked things out. She made two piles on the floor, one of valuables and one of what she called rubbish. Curious objects dangled from the tongs.
"Would you believe it? Her best lace handkerchiefs. And my big mattress needle. My silver thimble, if you please, and one of hers. And look, oh, my, at the walls, the cottons. No wonder you can never find a reel of white cotton if you want one. Potatoes, nuts, a pot of caviar. Caviar? No, it's too much. Dolls, chairs, tables, and look at all this blotting paper. So that's where it goes. Oh, my goodness gracious," she cried suddenly. "What's this?"
Mrs. Driver laid down the tongs and leaned over the hole, tentatively and fearfully, as though afraid of being stung.
"It's a watch. An emerald watch. Her watch. And she never missed it." Her voice rose. "And it's going. Look, you can see by the kitchen clock, 12:25.
Mrs. Driver sat down suddenly on a hard chair. Her face looked white and flabby as though deflated.
"You know what this means," she said to Crampfurl.
"No," he said.
"The police," said Mrs. Driver. "That's what this means. A case for the police."
The boy lay trembling a little beneath the bedclothes. The screwdriver was under his mattress. He had heard Mrs. Driver on the stairs, and he had run. He lay there waiting, but they did not come upstairs. After hours, it seemed, he heard the hall clock strike one. All seemed quiet below, and at last he slipped out of bed and crept along the passage to the head of the stairway. There was no sound but the steady tick of the clock. So quiet it was that at last he found courage to tiptoe down the staircase and along the kitchen passage. He listened a while outside the baize door, and at length, very gently, he pushed it open. The kitchen was filled with a greyish darkness. He felt, as Mrs. Driver had done, along the shelf for the matches, and he struck a light. He saw the gaping hole in the floor, and the objects piled beside it, and in the same flash he saw a candle on the shelf. He lit it clumsily with trembling hands. Yes, there they lay, the contents of the little home, higgledy-piggledy on the boards. Mrs. Driver had carried away all she considered valuable, and had left the rubbish. And rubbish it looked, thrown down like this. The house itself was a shambles. Partitions fallen, earth floors revealed, matchsticks, an old cogwheel, scattered bottle tops. The boy stared. Then, leaning down, he called softly, "Arietti! Arietti!" After a while, he called again. Something fell hot on his hand. It was a tear from his eye. Angrily, he brushed it away, and leaning farther into the hole, he called once more.
"Pod," he whispered. "Homily."
They appeared so quietly that at first, in the wavering light of the candle, he did not see them. Silent they stood, looking up at him with scared white faces.
"Where have you been?" asked the boy.
Pod cleared his throat. "Up at the end of the passage, under the clock."
"I've got to get you out," said the boy.
"Where to?" asked Pod.
"What about the attic?"
"That ain't no good," said Pod. "I heard them talking. They're going to get the police and a cat, and the sanitary inspector and the rat catcher from the town hall at Leighton Buzzard. There won't be nowhere in the house that's safe."
"Well, what about the doll's house on the top shelf in the schoolroom?" suggested the boy. "Even a cat can't get there."
Homily gave a little moan of assent.
"Yes," she said, "the doll's house."
"No," said Pod, in the same expressionless voice. "You can't live on a shelf. Maybe the cat can't get up, but no more can you get down. You're stuck. You've got to have water."
"I'd bring you water," said the boy.
"No," said Pod. "A shelf ain't no good. Besides, you'll be going soon." He drew a long breath. "We've got to emigrate," he said.
"Oh," moaned Homily softly, and Arietti began to cry.
"Now don't take on," said Pod in a tired voice. Arietti had covered her face with her hands, and her tears ran through her fingers.
"I'm not taking on," she gasped. "I'm so happy, happy."
"You mean," said the boy to Pod, but with one eye on Arietti,
"you'll go to the Badger set?"
He too felt a mounting excitement. "Where else?" asked Pod.
"Oh, my goodness gracious," moaned Homily. "But you've got to go somewhere tonight," said the boy. "You've got to go somewhere before tomorrow morning." "Oh, my goodness gracious," moaned Homily again.
"He's right at that," said Pod. "Can't cross them fields in the dark."
"I know," cried Arietti. Her wet face glistened in the candlelight. It was alight and tremulous, and she raised her arms as though about to fly. "Let's go to the doll's house just for tonight, and tomorrow..." She closed her eyes against the brightness of the vision. "Tomorrow the boy will take us. Take us..." And she could not say to where.
"Take us?" cried Homily in a strange, hollow voice.
"How?" "In his pockets," chanted Arietti. "Won't you?" "Yes," he said. "And bring the luggage up afterwards in a fish basket. I'll pick all the furniture out of this pile here and anything else you want."
"Tea," murmured Homily. "Enough for our lifetimes."
"All right," said the boy. "And coffee too, if you like, and cooking pots and matches. You'll be all right. But what do they eat? Wailed Homily. Caterpillars.
No, Homily, said Pod. Don't be foolish. We'll see all that when we get there.
I couldn't light a fire of sticks, said Homily, not in the wind. What if it rains? How do they cook in the rain?
Now, Homily, began Pod. He was beginning to lose patience, but Homily rushed on.
Could you get us a couple of tins of sardines, she asked the boy, and some salt, and could you bring us some carpets from the doll's house? Yes, said the boy, of course I could. Anything you want. All right, said Homily. She still looked wild, partly because some of her hair had rolled out of the curlers, but she seemed appeased. How are you going to get us up to the schoolroom? The boy looked down at his pocketless nightshirt.
I'll carry you, he said.
How? Asked Homily. In your hands?
Yes, said the boy.
I'd rather die, said Homily. I'd rather stay right here and be eaten by the rat catcher from the town hall in Leighton Buzzard.
The boy looked around the kitchen.
Shall I carry you in the peg bag? He asked at last, seeing it hanging on the handle of the scullery door.
All right, said Homily.
Take out the pegs first.
But she walked into it bravely enough when he laid it down on the floor. When he picked it up, Homily shrieked and clung to Pod and Arietti.
Oh! She gasped as the bag swayed. Oh, I can't! Stop it! Put me out! Oh!
And clutching and slipping, they fell into a tangle at the bottom.
Be quiet, Homily, can't you?
Exclaimed Pod angrily, and held her by the ankle. Arietti climbed up away from them and looked out over the edge.
Oh, I can't, cried Homily. Stop it, Pod! I'm dying! Tell him to put us down!
Put us down, said Pod in his patient way. Just for a moment. And, as once again the bag was placed beside the hole, they all ran out.
Look here, said the boy unhappily to Homily. You've got to try.
She'll try all right, said Pod. Give her a breather. All right, said the boy. But there isn't much time.
Listen, cried Pod sharply, and froze.
The boy, looking down, saw their three upturned faces catching the light. Like pebbles they looked, still and stony within the hole. And then, in a flash, they were gone. The boards were empty and the hole was bare. He leaned into it.
Pod! He called in a frantic whisper. Homily, come back!
And then he too became frozen. The scullery door creaked open. It was Mrs. Driver. Turning, the boy stared up at her.
Hello,
he said uncertainly. She did not smile, but something lightened in her eyes, a malicious gleam, a look of triumph.
What are you doing down here? She asked.
He stared at her but did not speak.
And what are you doing with the pig bag?
Still he stared at her, almost stupidly. The pig bag? He repeated, and looked down as though surprised to see it in his hand.
Nothing, he said. Was it you who put the watch in that hole?
No, he said. It was there already.
Ah, she said, and smiled. So you knew it was there?
No, he said. I mean, yes.
Do you know what you are? Asked Mrs. Driver. You are a sneaking, thieving, noxious little dribbit of no good.
His face quivered.
Why? He said. You know why. You're a wicked, black-hearted, fribbling little pickpocket, that's what you are. And so are they. They're nasty, crafty, scampy-scurvy, squeaking little... No, they're not, he put in quickly. And you are in league with them.
She came across to him, and taking him by the upper arm, she jerked him to his feet.
You know what they do with thieves? She asked. They lock them up. And that's what's going to happen to you.
I'm not a thief, cried the boy, his lips trembling. I'm a borrower. Oh, what? She swung him round by tightening the grip on his arm. A borrower, he repeated. There were tears on his eyelids. He hoped they would not fall.
So that's what you call it, she exclaimed,
as he himself had done, so long ago it seemed now, that day with Arietti.
That's their name, he said. The kind of people they are. They're borrowers.
Borrowers, eh? Repeated Mrs. Driver.
She laughed.
Well, they've done all the borrowing they're ever going to do in this house.
She began to drag him towards the door. Tears spilled over his eyelids and ran down his cheeks.
Don't hurt them, he begged. I'll move them, I promise.
Mrs. Driver laughed again and pushed him roughly through the green baize door.
They'll be moved all right, she said. Don't worry.
The rat catcher will know how.
Crampfell's old cat will know how. So will the sanitary inspector. The police'll know how, I shouldn't wonder. No need to worry about moving them.
Once you found the nest, she went on, dropping her voice to a vicious whisper as they passed Aunt Sophie's door,
the rest is easy.
She pushed him into the schoolroom and locked the door, and he heard the boards of the passage creak beneath her tread as, satisfied, she moved away. He crept into bed then and cried his heart out under the blankets.
And that, said Mrs. May, laying down her crochet hook, is really the end.
Kate stared at her.
But it can't be, she gasped. Oh, please, please.
The last square, said Mrs. May, smoothing it out on her knee. The 150th. Now we can sew them together.
Oh, said Kate, breathing again, the quilt. I thought you meant the story.
Which is the end of the story, too, said Mrs. May absently.
In a way. And she began to sort out the squares.
But, stammered Kate, you can't, I mean...
And she looked quite suddenly, everything they had said she was, wild, self-willed, and all the rest of it.
It's not fair, she cried. It's cheating, it's...
Tears sprang to her eyes. She threw her work down on the table.
Something more must have happened. What about the rat catcher and the policeman and...
But something more did happen, said Mrs. May. A lot more happened. I'm going to tell you.
Then why did you say it was the end?
Because, said Mrs. May, he never saw them again.
Then how can there be more?
Because, said Mrs. May, there is more.
Kate glared at her. All right, she said. Go on. Mrs. May looked back at her.
Kate, she said, stories never really end. They can go on and on and on. It's just that sometimes, at a certain point, one stops telling them.
But not at this kind of point, said Kate.
Well, thread your needle, said Mrs. May, and we'll sew these squares together. First a grey square, then an emerald, then a pink, and so on.
Then you didn't really mean it, said Kate irritably, trying to push the folded wool through the narrow eye of the needle, when you said he never saw them again.
But I did mean it, said Mrs. May. I'm telling you just what happened. He had to leave suddenly at the end of the week, because there was a boat for India and a family who could take him. And for 3 days before he left, they kept him locked up in those two rooms.
For 3 days, exclaimed Kate.
Yes. Mrs. Driver, it seemed, told Aunt Sophie that he had a cold. She wasn't unkind to him, but she was determined, you see, to keep him out of the way until she got rid of the borrowers.
And did she? Asked Kate. I mean, did they all come? The policeman and the rat catcher and the...
The sanitary inspector didn't come. And they didn't have the rat catcher from the town hall, but they had a local man.
The policeman came. Mrs. May laughed.
During those 3 days, Mrs. Driver used to give my brother a running commentary on what was going on below. She used to bring his meals up, and on that first morning, she brought all the doll's furniture up on the breakfast tray and made my brother put it back in the doll's house.
It was then she told him about the policeman.
Furious, he said she was. He felt almost sorry for her.
Why? Asked Kate. Because the policeman turned out to be Nellie Runacre's son, Ernie, a boy Mrs. Driver had chased many a time for stealing russet apples.
A nasty, thieving drippet of no good, she told my brother. Sitting down there he is now in the kitchen, large as life, with his notebook out, laughing fit to bust. 21, he says he is now, and as cheeky as you make 'em.
And was he, asked Kate, a drippet of no good?
Of course not, any more than my brother was. Ernie Runacre was a fine, upstanding young man and a credit to the police force. And he did not actually laugh at Mrs. Driver, but he gave her what Crampfell described afterwards as an old-fashioned look when she described Homily in bed. Take more water with it, it seemed to say.
More water with what? Asked Kate.
The fine old pale Madeira, I suppose, said Mrs. May. And great-aunt Sophie had the same suspicion. She was furious when she heard that Mrs. Driver had seen several little people when she herself on a full decanter had only risen to one.
Did they get a cat? Asked Kate.
Yes, they did. But that wasn't much of a success either. It was Crampfell's cat, a large yellow Tom. According to Mrs. Driver, it had only two ideas in its head, to get out of the house or go into the larder.
Talk of burrowers, Mrs. Driver would say. That cat's a burrower, if ever there was one. Burrowed the fish, that cat did, and a good half bowl of egg sauce. But the cat wasn't there long. The first thing the rat-catcher's terriers did was chase it out of the house. The last glimpse my brother had of the cat was streaking away through the spinney and across the fields with the terriers after it.
Did they catch it?
No, Mrs. May laughed. It was still there when I went a year later. A little morose, but as fit as a fiddle.
Tell me about when you went.
Oh, I wasn't there long, said Mrs. May rather hastily. And after that, the house was sold. My brother never went back.
Kate stared at her suspiciously. So they never caught the little people?
Mrs. May's eyes flicked away. No. They never actually caught them, but... She hesitated. As far as my poor brother was concerned, what they did do seemed even worse.
What did they do?
Mrs. May laid down her work and stared for a moment thoughtfully at her idle hands.
I hated the rat catcher, she said suddenly.
Why? Did you know him?
Everybody knew him. His name was Rich William. He was also the pig killer, and, well, he did other things as well. He had a gun, a hatchet, a pickaxe, and a contraption with bellows for smoking things out. I don't know what the smoke was exactly. Poison fumes of some kind. I only remember the smell of it. It clung round the barns or wherever he'd been. You can imagine what my brother felt the day he was leaving, when suddenly he smelled that smell. He was all dressed and ready to go. Mrs. Driver came and unlocked the door and took him down the passage to Aunt Sophie. He stood there stiff and pale beside the curtained bed. "Seasick already?" Aunt Sophie mocked him.
"No," he said. "It's that smell."
Aunt Sophie lifted her nose. She sniffed.
"What smell is it, Driver?"
"It's the rat catcher, m'lady," explained Mrs. Driver, reddening. "Down in the kitchen."
"What?" exclaimed Aunt Sophie. "Are you smoking them out?"
And she began to laugh.
"Oh, dear, dear," she gasped. "And if you don't like them, Driver, the remedy's simple."
"What is it, m'lady?" asked Mrs. Driver, and even her chins were red. Helpless with laughter, Aunt Sophie waved a ringed hand.
"Keep the bottle corked," she managed at last.
They heard her laughing still as they went on down the stairs.
"She don't believe in them," muttered Mrs. Driver.
"More fool her. She'll change her tune when I take them up afterwards, laid out on a clean piece of newspaper."
and she dragged my brother unceremoniously across the hall. The clock had been moved, exposing the wainscot, and, as he saw at once, the hole had been blocked and sealed. The front door was open, and the sunshine streamed in. The bag stood there beside the fibre mat, cooking a little in the golden warmth. The fruit trees beyond the bank had shed their petals and were lit with a tender green.
"Plenty of time," said Mrs. Driver, glancing up at the clock. "The cab's not due till 3:30.
"The clock stopped," said my brother. Mrs. Driver turned. She was wearing her hat and her best black coat, ready to take him to the station. She looked strange and tight and chapel-going.
"So it has," she said.
Her jaw dropped, and her cheeks became heavy and pendulous.
"It's moving it," she decided. "It'll be all right once we get it back." And she dragged again at his arm above the elbow.
"Where are we going?"
he asked, holding back. "Along to the kitchen."
"Don't you want to see them caught?"
"No," he said.
"No,"
and he pulled away from her. Mrs. Driver stared at him, smiling a little. "I do," she said. "I'd like to see 'em close. He puts this stuff in and they come running out. At least that's how it works with rats. But first, he says, you have to block up all the exits." And her eyes followed my brother's to the hole below the wainscot.
"How did they find it?"
he asked then. Putted it looked, and with a square of brown paper pasted on crooked. "Rich William found it. That's his job."
"They could unstick that," said the boy.
Mrs. Driver laughed. "Oh, no, they couldn't. Cemented firm, that is. A great block of it right inside with a sheet of iron across." "Come on now," said Mrs. Driver. "We'll hear the cab from the kitchen." But the kitchen, as she dragged him past the baize door, seemed a babble of sound. No approaching cab could be heard here.
"Steady, steady,
Cramphurl was saying on one loud note as he held back the rat-catcher's terriers, which shrilled and panted on the leash. The policeman was there. He had come out of interest and stood back from the others a little in view of his calling, with a cup of tea in his hand and his helmet pushed off his forehead. But his face was pink with boyish excitement.
"Seeing's believing," he said cheerfully to Mrs. Driver when he saw her come in at the door.
A boy from the village was there with a ferret. It kept sort of pouring out of his pocket, my brother said, and the boy kept pushing it back. Rich William himself was crouched on the floor by the hole. He had lighted something beneath a piece of sacking, and the stench of its smouldering eddied about the room. He was working the bellows now, with infinite care, stooping over them, rapt and tense. My brother stood there as though in a dream. "Perhaps it was a dream," he said to me later, much later, after we were all grown up. He gazed round the kitchen. He saw the sunlit fruit trees through the window, and a bough of the cherry tree which stood on the bank. He saw the empty teacups on the table, one without a saucer. He saw, propped against the wall, close beside the baize door, the rat-catcher's belongings, a bundle of rabbit snares, two sacks, a spade, a gun, and a pickaxe.
"Stand by now,"
Rich William was saying. There was a rising note of excitement in his voice.
"Stand by! Ready now to slip the dogs!"
Mrs. Driver let go my brother's arm and moved towards the hole.
"Keep back," said the rat-catcher. "Give us room."
And Mrs. Driver backed nervously towards the table. She put a chair beside it and half-raised one knee, but lowered it again when she caught Ernie Runacre's mocking glance.
"All right, Ma," he said. "We'll give you a leg up when the time comes."
And Mrs. Driver threw him a furious look. She snatched up the three cups from the table and stumped away with them in the direction of the scullery.
"Save me the smudge of something or other," my brother heard her mutter as she brushed past him.
And at those words, my brother came to life. He threw a quick glance about the kitchen. All eyes were on the rat-catcher. Stealthily, my brother began to move backwards, slowly, slowly, towards the green baize door. As he moved, he kept his eyes on the group around the hole. He paused a moment beside the rat-catcher's tools,
and stretched out a wary, groping hand. His fingers closed at last on a wooden handle. Smooth it was, and worn with wear. He glanced down quickly to make sure. Yes, it was the pickaxe. He leaned back a little, and pushed almost imperceptibly against the door with his shoulders. It opened sweetly in its silent way. Not one of the men had looked up.
"Steady now," the rat-catcher was saying, stooping closely over the bellows. "It takes a moment to go right through. There ain't much ventilation, not under a floor."
My brother slid through the barely open door, and it sighed to behind him, closing out the noise. He took a few steps on tiptoe down the dark kitchen passage, and then he ran. There was the hall again, steeped in sunshine, with his bags beside the door. He bumped against the clock, and it struck a note, a trembling note, urgent and deep. He raised the pickaxe to the height of his shoulder and aimed a sideways blow at the hole below the wainscot. The paper tore. A few crumbs of plaster fell out, and the pickaxe rebounded sharply, jarring his hands. There was indeed iron behind the cement. Again he struck, and again and again. The wainscot above the hole became split and scratched, but still the pickaxe bounced. It was no good. His hands, wet with sweat, were sliding and slipping on the wood. He paused for breath, and looking out, he saw the cab. He saw it on the road, beyond the hedge on the far side of the orchard. Soon it would reach the russet apple tree beside the gate. Soon it would turn into the drive. He glanced up at the clock. It was ticking steadily. The sound gave him comfort and steadied his thumping heart. Time. That's what he needed. A little more time. "It takes a moment, like the rat catcher had said, to go right through. There ain't much ventilation, not under a floor." Ventilation. That was the word, the saving word. Pickaxe in hand, my brother ran out of the door. He stumbled once on the gravel path and nearly fell. Already, when he reached it, a thin filament of smoke was eddying out of the grating, and he thought, as he ran towards it, that there was a flicker of movement against the darkness between the bars. And that was where they would be, of course, to get the air. But he did not stop to make sure. Suddenly he heard behind him the crunch of wheels on the gravel and the sound of the horse's hooves. He was not, as I have told you, a very strong little boy, and he was only 9, not 10, as he boasted to Arietti. But with 2 great blows on the brickwork, he dislodged one end of the grating. It fell sideways, slightly on a slant, hanging, it seemed, by one nail. Then he clambered up the bank and threw the pickaxe with all his might into the long grass beyond the cherry tree. He remembered thinking as he stumbled back, sweaty and breathless, towards the cab, how that too, the loss of the pickaxe, would cause its own kind of trouble later.
"But," exclaimed Kate, "didn't he see them come out?"
"No. Mrs. Driver came along then in a flurry of annoyance. She bustled him into the cab because she wanted to get back again, she said, as fast as she could to be in at the death." Kate sat silent a moment, looking down.
"So that is the end," she said at last.
"Yes," said Mrs. May, "in a way. Or the beginning."
"But," Kate raised a worried face, "perhaps they didn't escape through the grating."
"Oh, they escaped all right," said Mrs. May lightly.
"But how do you know?"
"I just know," said Mrs. May.
"But how did they get across those fields, with the cows and things and the crows?"
"They walked, of course. The Hendrearys did it. People can do anything when they have a mind to."
"But how would they know the way?"
"By the gas pipe," said Mrs. May. "There's a kind of ridge all along through the spinney and across the fields."
"But poor Homily. She didn't have her tea or her carpets. Do you suppose they took anything?"
"Oh, people always grab something," said Mrs. May shortly. "The oddest things sometimes, if you read about shipwrecks."
She spoke hurriedly, as though she were tired of the subject. "Do be careful, child. not grey next to pink. You'll have to unpick it. But, went on Kate in a despairing voice as she picked up the scissors, Homily would hate to arrive there all poor and destitute in front of Luppy.
Destitute, said Mrs. May patiently.
And Luppy wasn't there, remember.
Homily would be in her element.
Can't you see her?
Oh, those poor silly men, she would cry, and would tie on her apron at once.
Were they all boys?
Yes, harpsichords and clocks. And they'd spoil Arietti dreadfully. Did they eat caterpillars, do you think?
Oh, goodness, child, of course they didn't.
Badgers' sets are almost like villages, full of passages and chambers and storehouses. They could gather hazelnuts and beechnuts and chestnuts. They could gather corn, which they could grind into flour. It was all there for them. They had honey. They could make elderflower tea and lime tea. They had hops and haws and blackberries and sloes and wild strawberries. The boys could fish in the stream, and a minnow to them would be as big as a mackerel is to you. They had birds' eggs for custards and cakes and omelettes. They had greens and salads, of course. Think of a salad made of those tender shoots of young hawthorn. Bread and cheese, we used to call it, with sorrel and dandelion and a sprinkling of thyme and wild garlic. Homily was a good cook, remember. It wasn't for nothing that the clocks lived under the kitchen.
But the danger, cried Kate, the weasels and the crows and the stoats.
Yes, agreed Mrs. May, of course there was danger. There's danger everywhere. But no more for them than for many of us. At least they didn't have wars. These were boys, remember. They would learn to hunt for the pot and how to protect themselves. I don't suppose that Arietti and Homily would wander far afield.
Arietti would, said Kate.
Yes, said Mrs. May, laughing. I suppose Arietti might.
So they'd have meat, said Kate.
Yes, sometimes. But borrowers are borrowers, not killers.
I think, said Mrs. May, that if a stoat, say, killed a partridge, they might borrow a leg.
But they couldn't cook in the badger's set. I suppose they cooked out of doors.
How would they keep warm in winter?
Do you know what I think? Said Mrs. May. She laid down her work and leaned forward a little. I think that they didn't live in the badger's set at all. I think they used it as a great honeycomb of an entrance hall. Borrowers love passages, and they love gates, and they love to live a long way from their own front doors.
Where would they live, then?
I was wondering, said Mrs. May, about the gas pipe.
Oh, yes, cried Kate. I see what you mean.
The soil's all soft and sandy up there. I think they dig out a circular chamber level with the gas pipe, and off this chamber, all around it, there'd be little rooms like cabins. And I think, said Mrs. May, that they'd bore three little pinholes in the gas pipe. One would be so tiny that you could hardly see it, and that one would always be alight. The other two would have stoppers in them, which, when they wanted to light the gas, they would pull out. They would light the bigger ones from the small burner. That's where they'd cook, and that would give them light.
But would they be so clever?
But they are clever, Mrs. May assured her. Very clever. Much too clever to live near a gas pipe and not use it. They're borrowers, remember.
But they'd want a little air hole.
Oh, said Mrs. May quickly. They did have one.
How do you know?
Asked Kate.
Because once, when I was up there, I smelled hot pot.
Oh, cried Kate excitedly. She twisted round and knelt up on the hassock. So you did go up there. So that's how you know you saw them too.
No, no, said Mrs. May, drawing back a little in her chair. I never saw them. Never.
But you went up there. You know something, I can see you know.
Yes, I went up there. Mrs. May stared back into Kate's eager face. Hesitant, she seemed almost a little guilty.
Well, she conceded at last, I'll tell you.
When I went to stay in that house, it was just before Aunt Sophie went into the nursing home. I knew the place was going to be sold, so I... Again, Mrs. May hesitated, almost shyly. Well, I took all the furniture out of the doll's house and put it in a pillowcase and took it up there. I bought things, too, out of my pocket money, tea and coffee beans and salt and pepper and cloves and a great packet of lump sugar. And I took a whole lot of little pieces of silk which were left over from making a patchwork quilt.
But you never saw them?
No, I never saw them. I sat for hours against the bank below the hawthorn hedge. Perhaps it was the wrong place. I don't think so. Sitting there in the grass, half dreaming and watching beetles and ants, I found an oak apple. It was smooth and polished, and there was a hole bored in one side of it and a slice off the top.
The teapot! Exclaimed Kate.
I think so. I looked everywhere, but I couldn't find the quill spout. I called down all the holes as my brother had done, but no one answered. Next day, when I went up there, the pillowcase had gone.
And everything in it?
Yes, everything. I searched the ground for yards around in case there might be a scrap of silk or a coffee bean, but there was nothing. That was the day, said Mrs. May, smiling, that I smelled hot pot.
And which was the day, asked Kate, that you found Arietti's diary?
Mrs. May laid down her work.
Kate,
she began in a startled voice,
what makes you say that?
Her cheeks had become quite pink.
I guessed, said Kate. I knew there was something you wouldn't tell me, like reading somebody else's diary.
It wasn't the diary, said Mrs. May hastily, but her cheeks had become even pinker. It was the book called Memoranda, the book with blank pages. That's where she'd written it. And it wasn't on that day that I found it, but 3 weeks later, the day before I left.
Kate sat silent, staring at Mrs. May.
After a while, she drew a long breath.
Then that proves it, she said finally. Underground chamber and all.
Not quite, said Mrs. May.
Why not? Asked Kate.
Arietti used to make her E's like little half moons with a stroke in the middle.
Well, said Kate.
Mrs. May laughed and took up her work again.
My brother did too, she said.
This audiobook was produced and published by Penguin Books Limited.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.